What is shaking, everybody? Welcome back to the Wind Up Podcast. I am your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and it is May question and answer time. It is a perfect time to dive into a bunch of questions that have been submitted to us over the last month, and also dive into a few more that were asked of us during our round of road trips through late March all the way through April and into early May. In fact, on the road, here we are once again, a brand new hotel room for those of you that are watching on the YouTube channel. We are in Des Moines. After a couple of days back east, we went over to New York City and upstate New Jersey. Big shout out to Anita and Julio for having me out. It was an amazing dinner that they had set up with us, and just some great times, awesome wines, and fun people to hang out with. And now we're back in the Midwest, working our way back to Napa, slowly but surely. Before we dive into this month's questions, we, as always, have a couple of announcements. First and foremost, be sure to continue sharing the podcast wherever you're consuming the show. Dive into your the ratings and reviews. If you need to leave a quick rating or review, that's a huge help. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines. That's on the Book of Face, Instagram, the social network formerly known as Twitter, and I'm missing one, YouTube, of course, obviously, where if you're watching this, that's where you're consuming it. Be sure to check out the YouTube channel as well for tasting notes. We're posting some of our new releases to give you a little bit more insight on some of the new wines that have been coming out this year. We also have just kind of we post on the shorts all the time, and we try and spread them out all over all the networks to kind of give you the day-to-day in the life of the winemaker, doing all the things, wearing all the hats in a wine business. So be sure to check those out. All right, that's enough announcements for the day. Oh, actually, it's not. I lied. There's one more. Now that we're kind of through the bulk of our spring and early summer travel season, we are starting to line up the fall after harvest. So for those of you that are interested in hosting an event, coming out to the winery, checking us out, head to our website, mtgawines.com. You can either schedule a tasting appointment in the top nav, or if you scroll down a little ways and want more information on creating your own wine events or curating a special tasting experience, we do have an email form towards the bottom of our homepage that you can submit any questions, and myself or Brittany will either get back to you to help kind of dial things in. So now we're done with announcements. Let's get into the May Q&A, and we are covering a plethora of topics. I'm gonna try and get through all of these. There's a halfway decent chance that some of these bleed over into the June Q&A because there's just a lot to cover. This is actually an episode I'm recording, of course, on the road in this lovely hotel room. I'm recording it a little early so that it's gonna post when it's supposed to at the end of the month. It's actually May 17th right now. This will be coming out on the 29th, I believe, officially. So that's when you're listening to it. So greetings from the past. But because all these questions have been just coming at us over the last month of travel, I felt this is gonna be a great time to really dive into them while it's fresh of mind, and give you hopefully the best perspective that kind of we can when it comes to some of these industry things. Actually, one sec.
Is this gonna help?
Nope, that light doesn't even work. All right, cool, this hotel room, that light doesn't work, it's fine. All right, without further ado, I was trying to adjust the lighting. It seems a little dark, but it will be all right. All right, first and foremost, we start off with a heavy hitter that was asked actually last night at our wine dinner, and it was from one of our good friends and clients that live out in Florida, and she very kindly asked, stated, you know, what we've, you know, been talking about in a couple of episodes, is the wine industry in trouble? They've seen a lot of articles over the last couple of months that tourism is slowing down, the Napa wine industry is struggling, the wine industry and alcohol industry as a whole is kind of in a little bit of a decline. What's going on? Should we be worried? How's it really gonna impact things? And to be quite honest and frank about this, this is something that I saw coming. I don't feel as though there's anyone else really that feels that way, which is so strange to me. I don't know. It feels like I can see through the matrix when other people can't, because we had such an amazing amount of unbridled growth through 2020, and in 2021, things were just gangbusters for us. People were drinking more wine than ever. Sales were, it was a huge boon, especially kind of as we're crawling our way out of COVID in 2021. And through the second half, or through the first half of 22, things were just, it was on a tear. It was amazing. And if you've been in this industry for any period of time, you know that there are ebbs and flows to wine sales. And there are a lot of people freaking out right now because their sales are down. They might have been down last year as well. And now this year's off to a really slow start. Them is the ropes. But it's easy just to say that and be like, hey, this is just one of these, you know, trends that we can, waves that we have to ride. But let me give you a little bit of perspective in terms of why this is happening. Number one, no, I don't think the industry is in trouble. That's the short answer. The long answer is that there have been multiple factors over the last few years that have been, you know, a great boon that led right into this kind of doldrum that we're in. Number one, through a portion of late 2022 and into 2023, if you were in Denver and east in the country, it was cheaper to fly to Europe than it was to fly to Napa, you know, the Bay Area, Sacramento, whatever the case is. So, you know, number one, the cost of just getting out to us was pricey. Hotel rooms had jacked up their rates, you know, from what are already expensive rates at $300, $400 a night to $500, $600, $800 a night for what are pretty basic accommodations when it comes to hotel rooms. I mean, stuff that's not nearly as nice as this in downtown Des Moines, and it was four times the price of this. Just outrageous. Number three, you had wine prices increasing. You know, through the kind of COVID supply chain crisis, the cost of all the goods we're using, you know, went up 20, 30, 40%. We've already talked about kind of the grape market, and you can go back and listen to that episode and kind of how things have changed over the last 4 years, you know, kind of using Cabernet as the example, that the price per ton for Cabernet Sauvignon in Napa is up 40% since 2020, 2021. It's crazy. So just the sheer expense of everything, it's hard for me to say, hey, keep coming out to Napa when everything is so expensive. I get it. Like it's, and many folks have been here, you know, over the last couple of years and like, you know what, let's go travel somewhere else. Let's do something else. We can get more bang for our buck doing other things. We love Napa. We'll be back, but we're just going to skip it this year. Maybe we skip it next year. Those are just kind of some of the economic factors. You also have, you know, kind of that COVID mentality of where happy hours kept getting earlier and earlier and earlier. People were drinking and as a result buying more wine than they really ever had. And now you have people that have purchased a lot of wine, they're in a lot of wine clubs, and they're saying, hey, we need a little break to catch up on what we have laying around. You know, we're back at work, I'm not popping a bottle of wine open at noon, you know, to go with my lunch before this Zoom call I got, you know, at 3 o'clock. You know, things are a little bit more, you know, coming to an equilibrium in terms of consumption, just in general, in my opinion. So you have all this stuff that's kind of working against what was kind of this big boon of a year like 2021. And quite frankly, the businesses that acted as if, hey, we're going to see this double-digit growth, this these amazing sales trends for years and years and years to come, if that was your forecasting, you're doing it wrong. Plain and simple, bar none, you did your business a disservice. Because this is how this industry ebb and flows. It was no different during the 08 to, you know, 11 recession. You know, there have been plenty of examples of this prior to that as well. This shouldn't really be a surprise to anybody. You can also, I mean, folks are talking about the generational side of things as well, you know, with Gen Z starting to come into, you know, their drinking age. You know, the oldest of them are 27, so still maybe not quite available, you know, not quite able to purchase and enjoy fine wine on a regular basis because they need stable jobs, they need stability in their lives, they need homes, they need, you know, partners, they need whatever they need to, you know, make wine seem worth it to enjoy. So we're in that generational shift right now, which is the same thing that happened to the millennial generation, my generation. Go back and check out our generational episode that we posted earlier this month. We kind of dive into that topic a little bit further. So, long story longer, is Napa wine industry really in trouble? No. I think this is simply that little reset that we normally experience after these really big kind of great years. It levels off, and for some people it's down, some people it's flat, some people they actually do okay. And it just kind of depends how you've approached all these years. You know, if you are expecting another 15, 20% of growth this year, sorry, it's not happening. If you were expecting that last year, probably not happening either. So, you know, you really have, these are those times where you really should be conservative. This is where I got in a lot of trouble with some of my day jobs, is that I was an ultra conservative planner. I wanted growth, much like the, you know, my bosses and the owners wanted growth. But I always said, hey, like, it's nice that we had this great year, but understand, like, this is not sustainable. This is not, you know, it's just, it's not gonna work. I tend to be very much a realist in terms of the numbers when you're looking at burn rates and traffic and all this other stuff that you're trying, and you know, your pricing and everything. Like, I really dive into that kind of stuff because I geek out on it. And you just have to be a little bit conservative in this industry. You know, feel free to go big or go home, but if you're struggling right now because you did that and now you're up a creek without a paddle, unfortunately, that's on you. So I don't think the industry as a whole is in trouble. This is a rocky moment within the industry. We'll get through it. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. I promise. It'll all be good. All righty. Question number two. This is something that happened actually when we were back in Kansas City earlier in the month. We mentioned this. We've mentioned this many, many times over the course of the last year of doing the show when it comes to wine additives. And when it comes to what or how you can find out exactly what's actually going into the wines that you enjoy. And that's what the question is. How can you tell when you're looking at a store shelf, how can you tell exactly what is going into the wines that you enjoy or that you're purchasing from a winemaking perspective? The short answer is you can't. You have to get in touch with the winery because the vast majority of them don't share this kind of information. I brought this question back up because I was doom scrolling through Instagram as I was sitting in an airport today on my way out to Des Moines. And shoot, I can't remember his name. But someone that we mentioned in a prior episode from the Punch Drink article from Monterio Sellers. And he was kind of having this great post. I think his name's Patrick, but I don't remember his last name. He was mentioning and kind of having this like almost like come to Jesus moment about saying, hey, you know, we use sulfites, we use cross flow filtration to make sure our wines are stable and we want our wines to be better and good. And I think good on him, he admitted that, hey, some of the early wines that I was doing like as natural as possible, many of you know my opinion on natural winemaking that I think is trash. You know, he found that the proof was in the pudding that, hey, some of these conventional methods make better, more stable, yummier wine. So I love the fact that he was being honest and upfront about using sulfites, because that's what we do. I love the fact that he's honest and upfront about, you know, being honest about his filtration practices. And more wineries should follow suit. That's why we started doing it. Because the reality is you can't find out this information unless a winery is willingly sharing it. And even then it might be tough to track down because it means, you know, going to their website, sorting through their web pages, finding tech sheets and tasting notes. It's why, you know, for us, we're putting a QR code on the back of all of our labels starting this year to make sure that, hey, if you want quick and easy access to that info, there it is. Take it. You can, all the information's gonna be out there. So, you know, as it stands right now, because that's not the major trend within the industry, wineries, you know, kind of keep this stuff buttoned up. We did another hotel room episode when I was in Pittsburgh at the end of March called Why Don't Wineries Share? Go back, check that out. Definitely check out our episode from last year about wine additives and kind of how some of this integrates into wine production and kind of what we're really talking about as from a broader perspective. But the best thing you can do is when you find a wine you like, number one, earmark it, be like, hey, I know this, I enjoy this wine. And from there, try and do a little research. I know it's a pain in the ass. I know you don't want to have to do that. You don't want to have to call them and be like, hey, I want to know more about your wines. You don't want to have to, you know, dig through pages and pages and pages on their website. Unfortunately, unless you're someone like us, or other small producers that are actually publicizing this information, you're not going to be able to find it. So, it's a bummer. It shouldn't have to be that way. I think there are a lot of us that are trying to change that, or at least there's a few of us anyway. And hopefully it's something that catches on in the future. So if you're trying to find out, you know, what's actually going into your wines, it's a matter of you kind of picking up a mouse and keyboard and doing the research yourself or making a phone call to figure out actually what's going on. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. All right. In tandem with that, how do you find good wines in your local wine shops or restaurants? This was also from an event this month with someone who was honestly intimidated by, you know, looking at just a wine list, like opening up that book and be like, shit, there's, you know, 200 wines here. How do I figure out what one to pick? Or going into a wine shop and just seeing row and row and row of, you know, wine after wine after wine and not knowing where to start. And this is the best advice you'll ever get from anybody in the industry in terms of how to sort through a wine list or sort through shelves in a retail shop. And it's super easy. You might be a little out of some of your comfort zones, but it is super easy. And that is asking for help. Find someone in that shop who knows what's on those shelves. In that restaurant, find out if there's someone, whether it's the bartender, a sommelier, whatever, find out if there's someone there that knows about the wines that they have on their list and just ask, hey, I'm interested in wine. I'm not really sure where to start. Here's what I like. And this is where it's nice to have that ballpark of like, hey, I like really bright, dry, refreshing rosé. Or hey, you know what? I like white wines that aren't, you know, super acidic and maybe are a little bit sweeter. You know what I want? Just a nice, sexy, smooth red blend. I want the biggest, baddest Cabernet you got. Having that, the ability to ask that question and just ask for help with a little bit of framework. You don't need to be a somm. You don't need a pin on your lapel. You don't need a WSET certification to ask these questions. You can ask them very honestly and very frankly and be like, hey, here's what I'm interested in. What do you got? That's all. That is the best advice I can give. I promise you, you're probably going to find some wines you love. You might find some wines you don't like. And the best part is, if you find a wine you don't like, you can go back into that same shop, that same restaurant, and be like, hey, you recommended this last time. It was a little edgy for me, or maybe it was a little too sweet for me. Do you have something else in the same vein, but that's a little bit different? And you can start to kind of build that repertoire of wines in your head to really kind of, you know, flesh out your own profile of wines you love to enjoy. So the A number one thing, whenever you're shopping for wine, if you're feeling intimidated and out of your comfort zone, is to ask for help. You know, I admittedly, because I'm a dude, I don't ask for directions. I don't ask for help. I just wing it and hope for the best because that's what us guys do, you know? So don't be me, you know, try to actually ask for help. That it's a huge thing that will go a very long way in terms of your overall enjoyment of wine when it's all said and done, because you'll learn a lot in the process. All right, question number three. We're actually rattling right through these, which is great. Question number three. Okay. Something else that comes up kind of all the time, especially as we're talking about our wines, because we don't own our own vineyards or purchasing grapes from other people. When working with grape growers, how much control do you have over the growing season and the harvest season? Frankly, all of the control. This is something that's kind of built into the contracts that we put together, is that if we're paying good money for this fruit, that we have the ability to adjust, critique, and, you know, make sure that we're getting what we want out of that vineyard. Plain and simple. Because if it comes harvest time, and let's say, because I actually had this happen 2 years ago in 2022, We had a vineyard. Oh, no, actually, it was last year. It was 2023. We had a vineyard that we were working with that shorted us on the fruit that we were contracted with. And there was another buyer for another section of the vineyard. And I said, hey, you know, we're contracted for this much. You know, what's like yields are kind of up around the valley. Like, why are we getting half as much as we're contracted for? And honestly, got not a great response. I was very, very frustrated because you're in the throes of harvest. And when you're expecting 6 tons and you get 3, you're like, hey, like I have like all this other stuff lined up. Like, what's going on here? And their answer was, hey, we have this other buyer. We need to make sure they get what they want. If there's anything left over, you can have it. And I was like, that's not going to work at all because they don't want to pick. This was, I called this pick for today because I wanted the fruit today. You know, I scheduled this like a week ahead of time. You know, if I'm going to wait another week, 2 weeks, that fruit's going to be well past the point where I wanted it. So I'm not going to take it. Even if it's available, I'm not taking it. So it was a bit of a kerfuffle, but we got through it. We found another small vineyard that had some great fruit that allowed us to kind of work on a dime and, you know, pivot and adjust so that we could actually get the quality that we wanted for the price that we wanted and not have to be like beholden to like someone else's choices. This was a huge point of contention that we sorted out. And luckily we still have a good relationship with this grower, but it's like, hey, you're kind of on thin ice. Like, we need to make sure that we actually get what we want. And that's just the harvest season in terms of scheduling picks and where we want the fruit to be in terms of its chemistry and flavor and everything that's going on. You know, through the growing season, you know, a lot of the vineyards that we work with have their own farming crews. They've been farming those vineyards for a long time. They know that land better than I do because they're the ones out there actually doing the day-to-day work. You know, I'm just kind of there to oversee it to make sure I'm, you know, I know enough to be dangerous when it comes to vineyard management so that I can make sure that I get what I want and what I need from a vineyard. So if I see something that's out of whack, if I see, you know, something that just doesn't seem right given like the forecast or the weather, you know, the yields that are out there, whether they're high, low, somewhere in between, you know, we can make adjustments. I know the right questions to ask. And it's a very good back and forth between the two of us to make sure that we typically end up on a nice level playing field. Exceptions like this last year with this one grower, that's, man, maybe the second time that's happened in 15 years that we've had an issue with a grower. Maybe the third time, but nothing was nearly as dramatic as getting half the fruit you were contracted for. So, you know, you figure it out one way or the other. It is the very nice thing about working with some of these growers, you know, over the long term, is that you don't want to burn a bridge that you've spent these years building. So you do your best to try and sort it out. And that's when we came to the table and had coffee at the beginning of this year to try and sort out what happened. We were like, hey, let's make sure that this is like ironed out. We got this all set and we're ready to rock and roll. So it's just a nice back and forth. We have probably, you know, more control than a lot of people expect, which is great for us, because we get to make sure that we get exactly what we want out of that vineyard so we can make the wines that you know, have come to love. That's how we go about things. I totally forgot to write down the timestamp for this. I'm pretty sure it was like around 21 minutes. I'm trying to do this like as we go, that way I don't have to watch this whole video back and try and track down. There's nothing like editing this show and having to listen to the sound of my own voice in a recording. It's super weird. I'm not a fan. So I try and like timestamp the question so I can put it in the description. That way I don't have to try and track it down. It makes my life a whole lot easier. All right, this question's a little bit more fun, which I really like. Speaking of which, let's make sure I write this down. there we go. When you're on the road and you have downtime, what do you do? Are you hunting for local wine bars, great wine lists, food pairings? What do you do when you're out and about? I don't do any of that. To be honest, I kind of avoid wine like the plague. I don't avoid it like the plague, but it's definitely kind of low on my list because of, you know, as you're doing all these dinners and all these events, you get wined out, you know. It's why so many winemakers drink beer and whiskey and other things, is because we're just inundated with it all the time. So we naturally change it up to make sure that we kind of experience something different. So let me give you a great example. When I was starting this road trip, we had a quick pit stop in Kansas City and then out to New York, where I was staying out towards Newark, actually. So I took the train into the Big Apple for just the afternoon. I took a red eye out. So I was there early, early in the morning. And it allowed me to be like, hey, I can just kind of wander around the city. I'm a huge fan of the Lower East Side. So I basically started at Houston. Yes, I'm going to say it's Houston, East Houston. It's not Houston. You guys are dumb. Houston, come on. And I just kind of started putzing around. I had to check Katz's Deli, or Katz's Deli off my list. So I went and got myself a pastrami sandwich and some pickles and a Brooklyn beer just as an appetizer for the afternoon. And was like, hey, this is just, my friends that know me know that I love great deli. And this was probably the best pastrami sandwich I've ever had. It's just delicious. The experience is great. It's everything that you would expect. I'm going back the next time I'm in the city, 100%. It's so good. And it's like, I just want something different that I can't get back home. So that's where I start. From there, I walked north a little ways. I ended up at McSorley's old time pub where I had a couple pints of the dark stuff, just kind of sat there. You know, people at this point, you know, you're pushing like 5-6 o'clock, so folks are like just getting off work, like the night's barely getting started, you know. And so it was nice to just kind of be there in the hustle and bustle, have a couple of beers, kind of hang out a little bit, and then continued on my way. So always love a good beer. In fact, that's probably what I'm gonna do after I'm done recording this. There's apparently a like German beer hall, like a 10 minute walk from this hotel. That's where I'm headed because I could use a pretzel and probably a Dunkel. You know, that's what I want. From McSorley's, where did I go? I went to this other bar, cocktail bar called the Belfry, I think it is. Kind of this like vibey, good music, good playlist, good cocktails. They had like a little like tropical tiki section of their cocktail list. And those that know I love a good tiki drink. So I was like, yep, let's go there. Let's check it out. See what we're all about. Sat there, had a cocktail, shot a Fernet just to help settle down that pastrami sandwich a little bit. From there, just continued walking around. I went over I think it was this udon noodle place on St. Mark's. Had a giant bowl of just some of the best noodles I've had in forever, and for like $20. It's like, oh yeah, shut up, take my money. You're lucky I can't eat two of these in one sitting because it was amazing. So didn't even have a beverage there. It was just like, I'm gonna have some water, some spicy noodles. It was like a beef udon with like kimchi and all kinds of other, the egg, everything in it. It was just the best. It was so good. Definitely going back there as well. It was super good. From there, I had a couple hours to kill. You know, we're starting to push like 8:30, 8:45 by this point. I was pretty close to the Comedy Cellar, and I was like, hey, they're probably sold out. They probably don't have any standby tickets available, but shoot, let's walk down there through Washington Square Park, see if they got anything going on. Walked by, and then, yep, sure enough, they were sold out, completely packed. I'm like, yeah, to be expected, whatever. You know, it's the way stand-up comedy is now. Like, you can't just, like, walk up to a club and get tickets, especially this one, because it's, you know, iconic. But I was like, yeah, let's give it a shot. And if we get in, we get in. Because there was a 9:30 showing, and I got there like at 8:50. And they're like, yeah, sorry, like we've been sold out already on tickets, and all the standby is already taken. Like, you can't even, don't think, sorry, you're going to have to try it another time. I was like, yep, totally get it. From there, just started making my way back to Newark. Jumped on the trains and made my way back. And that's like a typical night of what I do on the road when I've got like nothing to do, like tonight. You know, I'm going to go out to this German beer hall. Since I'm in Des Moines, I'm going to like El Bait Shop, I think it's called. Yeah, because actually I've gotten a bunch of recommendations of things to do in Des Moines. And I was like, hey, if you just need like some cheese curds and a burger or something, like that's the place you go to. So I'm like, all right, cool. I mean, it turns out there is a tiki bar here in town as well that I'll probably check out called Bellhop. It's a neighborhood tiki joint. It's like across a river or something from where I'm staying. So I'm like, all right, cool. We'll go have a couple of German beers. We'll go have some cheese curds and a burger. And then I'm going to go find another tiki bar that I'm going to live. I mean, hence like the pirate, you know, ship's wheel that I have, you know, hanging around me right now. So yeah, it's when I'm, you know, on the road like this, it's just kind of like, I don't ever really have plans or reservations. I'm not like actively hunting for places. It's just like, all right, let's go on some recommendations, you know, if I kind of hit a wall somewhere, then I jump on, you know, TripAdvisor or Yelp or something, and I try and track down, or just Google Maps, and I just kind of like see like what's in the area and click on little dots to see like what's actually going on. And from there, just see what kind of trouble I can get into. It's kind of the nice thing about being on the road like this is you do find in some, you know, you find yourself in some familiar places like New York City. This is definitely my first time to Des Moines in Iowa, period. So it's kind of like, all right, well, let's see what we have going on. We'll just kind of explore and see what we got happening. It's a great time. I love this part of the travel side of things, especially with a travel day, like being up super, super early, catching an early flight, and like you get to the hotel, take a nap, freshen up, record a podcast, and it's like, all right, let's go explore the city and see what we got going on. Man, we rattled through those questions. I actually had a couple others saved. Let me open up my laundry list of questions here. I didn't think I was going to get through this quite this fast. We just trucked right along. Ba-ba-ba. Let me open up my little Word doc here, because I do try to keep track of all of the questions that we have, because I'm sure I'm going to, you know, double dip and answer the same thing, you know, twice at some point. But I try to like, you know, try to, you know, keep it relatively fresh. That way y'all get, you know, the latest and greatest. Ba-ba-ba. Please hold while we pause for station identification. All right. All right, there we go. Ba-ba-ba-ba. All right, perfect. All right, timestamp it. There we go. Thank you for your patience as we roll through this. All right, for small producers trying to enter new markets and travel and build their brands, how do they go about it? What is it that got you out on the road? And what was it that has been successful, and what have the challenges been? This is a great, great question. It is, for a small business like ours, it's almost imperative, and almost for every wine business, it's imperative that you have someone on the road kind of pounding the pavement for sales. Whether you're a big company that's distributed all over the place, you have, you know, probably a sales rep in every state, you're working with distributors, you have people that are actively kind of pushing your wines. For us small people, maybe it's more the owner-operator coming out and doing events like we are, but in either case, you have someone kind of being your representative out on the road. So it's just kind of a different format, you know, depending on how you have it kind of framed, basically. You know, one of the reasons that MTGA and I was able actually to start working on MTGA full time was because of my travel efforts. The first trip I had planned, I left my day job. My last day was October 31st in 2018, right? Yeah, 2018. It'll be 6 years this year. And that weekend, I went right into 2 wine dinners. And after that, another 3 wine events. And that was when I was like, I have 3 months rent in the bank. I have 3 months to make the next 3 months. That was the mentality. And those first 5 events of working on my own is what springboarded me into being like, okay, we have some stability. You know, money is tight. We are still growing. This is going to take a lot of work. And this is through kind of 2019 that we kind of set up the framework, and actually, it allowed us to survive 2020 and having no tourism whatsoever coming to Napa. So it was weird timing because we only had like 1 full year of operation of me working for myself full time before COVID hit. But it was this travel side of things, both from a distribution perspective, but also from, you know, private dinners and for clients and things that allowed us to be successful as a brand. Every winery is going to have kind of a different strategy around this. We talked a little bit about this in one of our travel episodes in terms of like what makes a trip like worth it overall for a winery. It's going to be very subjective based on that business and kind of what they want. Some are certainly a little bit more like, hey, if I'm coming out, I need to sell X amount of wine, like X amount of bottles or X amount of dollars. Otherwise, I'm not coming. There are some of us that try and do more of a hybrid method where it's like, yes, we obviously need to sell wine while we're out on the road. but we also need to build relationships. We are also a growing brand. Like, we aren't selling out of wine at release. We have to hustle and we have to invest in long-term relationships, not just the quick hit of like instant big sales. So depending on like how you're structuring your wine business, whether you're gonna be more direct to consumer, you're gonna be more wholesale, or you're gonna be kind of this hybrid of both, you're gonna be pounding the pavement one way or the other. It just kind of depends on what works for you, what kind of playground you wanna play on when it comes to the wine industry, and what you think is going to create success for you. I can tell you that for small labels, direct to consumer is the way to go. You know, when we're distributing our wines, it's basically a marketing expense. We don't make any money on that. It's pretty much covering the costs of what we do because even when we're working with distributors, we're typically having to fly out, you know, work with them in those markets. I mean, plane tickets, hotels, meals, you know, we're spending money, you know, to sell our wine through them. And we're selling to them at such a deep discount so that they can mark it up and then the restaurant or retail shop can mark it up, that the margins are like, they're slim to nothing for businesses like ours. So we see it as a great way to introduce our wines to new people, you know, kind of, it's our advertising efforts, basically. It gives us the opportunity to come back to certain markets and cities and say, hey, let's do a wine dinner at this restaurant. And let's, you know, introduce some more people to the people, you know, behind the wine label and build some of these relationships that I've been talking about. So it's one way or the other. It's all about getting butts in seats and getting wine into glasses and sharing it with people, whether it's at a retail shop or at a country club or at someone's home or whatever the case is, and trying to build your brand, you know, in essence, the way you want and how you want to be successful and what you want to be doing. I can tell you firsthand that, you know, I have historically had a very hard time working with distributors. A lot of it annoys me. I have a lot of great friends. Shout out to, you know, everyone that I've worked with before, because I know you've put up with me being obnoxious and asking dumb questions and being pushy, because I am very impatient when it comes to the distribution side of things. Brittany, she loves it. She's all about that. She's the people person of this relationship for sure. I try and do a good job of it. She's the inspiration for it. But, you know, she loves that hustle. She loves going out there, being on the road, making new friends and hustling like that. For me, I'm a little bit more low key. I love more of the dialed in like wine dinners where I can be a little bit more one-on-one and personal with folks rather than sitting in a car and hitting, you know, 8 accounts in a day and, you know, having 2 minutes with each to try and sell wine to them. It's a very different vibe. And I know I can do both. The distribution, like sitting in the car and hitting up sales reps, is tough for me. I try and be good at it. I try and be nice about it. But it can be frustrating for me, where Brittany is like, let's tackle this head on. She's a little bit more of the go-getter in that sense. Where I prefer, you know, the little bit more dialed in, kind of longer form experiences, which is why our podcast is typically like 30 to 45 minutes long. I'm like, hey, let's sit here and chat, have a conversation, rather than the elevator pitch of, hey, here's my wine, here's how it's gonna make you money, right? Like, that's the difference realistically. So the benefit of being on the road is huge, whether you're big or small. You just have to decide what, you know, what realm you want to play in. And from there, you know, build a strategy around it, try and figure out what is going to work best for you in the long term. While also, as a part of that planning, not being beholden to any one thing. Throw stuff at the wall, see what sticks. If something doesn't work, you've learned something. And hopefully you didn't, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater doing one of those events. It's, you have to experiment, you know, with any industry. You know, the day you stop growing is the day you start dying. So you have to keep hustling. You have to keep throwing stuff at the wall. You have to keep being experimental. You know, do the tried and true stuff that works for you, but don't be afraid of exploring new revenue streams and opportunities. This is something that I think many wineries do fail at, is that they kind of get stuck within the box, like, here's how we want to operate, and they lose kind of that creative edge that allowed them to be successful in the first place, because they're like, here's what's working, we're just going to pound this, and they just beat it to death, and eventually they've got nowhere else to go, and they end up behind the eight ball all of a sudden. And I think that's going back to actually the very first question of this episode, you know, why some wineries are in trouble, is because some of them got complacent. That's the way it goes. Some businesses do that. They stop exploring new opportunities, new revenue streams. They're like, hey, we're killing it. We're just gonna let the people come to us. And that's when you find yourself in a lot of trouble and struggling. So, thank you so much for tuning in. It has been a wild ride on the road. If you're listening to this on Wednesday, whatever the date is, I am taking the weekend off. I'm going to the Bottle Rock festivities in Napa. I'm going to go see some music shows, kick back and relax a little bit, enjoy some nice, frothy, ice cold hops and infused beverages while listening to live music. It's going to be a blast. Hopefully we'll see some of you out there. I think some of you are actually attending the event, so we'll be around. Again, thank you all so much for the amazing support. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines. And for those of you that are interested in visiting the winery, doing events out on the road, anything of that nature, head to our website, mtgawines.com. You can schedule tastings in the top nav, or if you scroll down, you can hit up that email form and you can send us a note and we'll dial in all the details from there. Have an amazing rest of your week, weekend, and we will see you in June. Cheers.